This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The London transit system is struck again. Hello again, I'm Mormon Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In London today, what police call attempted bombings with eerie similarities to those of 2 weeks ago. But this time, no deaths and only a single injury. As police investigate possible links, Prime Minister Blair is urging Londoners to get on with their lives. On To the Point, how do officials explain today's events at a time of heightened alert and warnings of more to come? Will another attack on a trusted ally have an impact on the Patriot Act debate in Congress? On Reporter's Notebook later on, British efforts to crack down on potential terrorists and get them out of the country. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Mormon Olney, back with To the Point. British police say today's incidents on three subways and one bus were attempted bombings, similar to those of just 2 weeks ago. On To the Point, we'll hear from London and talk about possible impact on Capitol Hill. On Reporter's Notebook, Britain's reappraisal of immigration policy and the tradition of free speech in light of the London bombings. First, this news update. In Trafalgar Square this morning, Londoners met to remember the four transit bombings that killed 56 people exactly 2 weeks ago. But at lunchtime, there were four more attempted attacks, three in subways and one on a bus. Police Commissioner Ian Blair was asked if there's any connection.
There's a resonance here, isn't there? I mean, these are four attacks. There were four attacks before. Whether or not this is directly connected in the sense of carried out by the same group of people, however loosely knit that is, I think that's going to take just a little bit longer before we can qualify that.
The commissioner was also asked, could it have been worse?
Clearly, the intention must have been to kill. I mean, you don't do this with any other intention. And I think the important point is that the intention of the terrorists has not been fulfilled.
Again, that was the Police Commissioner of London, Ian Blair. Stryker McGuire is London Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Stryker, do you have a sense of how Londoners reacted today, just 2 weeks after such similar incidents happened before?
Well, everybody is a bit on edge anyway. And then at lunchtime today, you could see that people at first were just a bit more nervous. I have a feeling. I mean, I haven't been out on the street for the last hour or so, but I have a feeling that this might be becoming a little bit more worrisome than perhaps earlier in the day. Earlier in the day, I think there was a kind of general impression that this was some kind of nuisance bombing. But everybody knew at the time, you know, that there was obviously a copycat element to it. But there are just certain hints, including some of the things that the Met Police Commissioner, Sir Ian Blair, said in his press conference that suggest that there may have been more to this than we thought at first. For example, he talked about how some of the devices remain unexploded. That's worrisome. You know, we don't know exactly what he meant by that. We don't know what kind of explosives did not, in fact, go off. We obviously don't know a lot, but it looks like much more than a nuisance at this point than it did just even a few hours ago.
One of the things he said was that may provide a significant breakthrough in the investigation of the incidents of 2 weeks ago. What do you suppose he meant by that?
Well, what he meant was that the individuals who planted these bombs today are around and they're alive, unlike the ones who were involved 2 weeks ago. Presumably today what happened is that people dropped these backpacks or packages of whatever kind they were off, they would be first of all, they're around still, presumably alive. Secondly, they would have been captured on CCTV, these ubiquitous cameras in London. It means that there at least there's somebody out there that you can catch. And the police always like that. It just, you know, it means if they were to catch somebody, and if that person were somehow connected to the events of 2 weeks ago, that would be an enormous breakthrough.
There was one report that somebody who had dropped a rucksack on one of the trains and run away might have been chased by police into a hospital, and the hospital was subsequently evacuated, at least in part. Do we know anything more about that?
We don't. We don't. And it's actually been, you know, it's been a few hours. So I don't know what it means that we haven't heard more about that, but everybody is being kept well away from the scene there. We don't really know what the outcome of that part of the investigation might be.
Does it appear, however, that these or this attempt was a lot more crude than the one of 2 weeks ago, given what the consequences have been?
It certainly looks that way. It certainly looks cruder, you know, and the... You know, some people might argue that, maybe this was deliberately less consequential. That maybe it's just to put people in London on edge, but that it still could somehow be could have been organized by the same network of people who organized the incidents of 2 weeks ago. I just think at this point we don't know enough. And but it clearly is something that is that has got everybody on edge here. And the police, although they are hoping for a breakthrough, are also they must also be mystified by what exactly is going on here in London.
One of the questions, of course, that will arise is how could this have happened at a time when there was a heightened alert on the transit system in light of what happened 2 weeks ago and amidst warnings that something might happen again? Again, Stryker McGuire is London bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. On our program, we'll go back to London. We'll also look at the impact of today's events on Capitol Hill in Washington, where debate on the Patriot Act is getting underway. All that on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman, only back with To the Point. Still talking with Stryker McGuire, the London bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. You said a moment ago that it would appear that this was a much cruder effort than the one of 2 weeks ago. Certainly didn't have the same consequences.
Yes.
Once again, nobody killed. And apparently only one person injured. You were suggesting that might have been deliberate to put people on edge. Is it also a statement of a kind that the Londoners and London police don't have the kind of intelligence required or the ability to stop this sort of thing from happening?
Well, it's certainly a reminder that, you know, there's only so much you can do. Obviously, the city, the country, in fact, is on high alert at this point in time. And yet something like this can happen. I mean, the fact is that on any given day in London, you have, I think it's something like 2 million people moving around on the subways. And, you know, when I'm on the subway, I'm carrying a briefcase. You know, a lot of people are carrying things. There's really only so much you can do. And I think what today shows is that even with intelligence at its highest level, you cannot prevent everything.
Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, said today that the only way to really protect the transit systems would be to use the same technology that's used in airports. And he said that simply wouldn't apply, couldn't happen in London, particularly where there are transit stations where there simply isn't enough room for the kind of machinery required and for people to stand around.
Well, you can imagine there are so many entry points, it's just there are also ways. For example, a lot of the subways here are in fact not underground at all points. So, I mean, you know, you can imagine therefore that packages could be passed, things could be passed to people who are already on the train by people who aren't getting on the train themselves. It's a nightmare in terms of prevention. There's really only so much you can do.
Okay, Stryker McGuire, again, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
London Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Shortly after today's attacks in London, President Bush had this to say during a speech in Washington.
They don't understand our country, though. They don't understand that when it comes to the defense of universal freedoms, this country won't be frightened. We will defend ourselves by staying on the offense against these killers. We will find them overseas so we don't have to face them here at home. And at the same time, we understand that to defeat an ideology of hate, you work to spread an ideology of hope.
Once again, the president is speaking today after the events in London. The incidents today come just as the Congress is considering possible amendments to the Patriot Act, passed just 45 days after September 11th, with sunset provisions that will go out of effect unless they're reenacted. I want to introduce now Congressman Michael McCaul. He is a Republican from Texas, has the 10th District there, which stretches from Austin to the suburbs of Houston. He was recently chief of the Terrorism and National Security Office in the U.S. Department of Justice. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
I want to ask you, first of all, about, or in a moment, about, I should say, about the Patriot Act. But what's your response, your reaction to what happened in London today, and do you think that it'll have any impact on the debate on the Patriot Act?
Well, I think possibly it should. It's a reminder that we're still vulnerable to a terrorist attack. It's a reminder that the threat is still very, unfortunately, alive and well, and we have to do everything we can to protect this country, not only abroad, but right here at home. And I serve on the Homeland Security Committee, and it's an issue that I deal with just about every day up here.
So what do you think are the lessons then, and particularly how would they apply to the amendments that not you but others are asking in the Patriot Act?
Well, I think intelligence is probably the most important issue here, and the ability to get intelligence in real time and information and act on it in a timely manner. Moving rapidly in real time is the way we're going to prevent terrorist attacks. It is the way we have prevented terrorist attacks in this country since 9/11. And I believe, particularly given my work in counterterrorism, that we need to give law enforcement every tool available to protect the homeland.
We were going to have with us today Congresswoman Jane Harman, who's the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee and who's one of those who was asking for changes. The Patriot Act, of course, was passed once again with provisions that sunsetted or will sunset, go out of effect unless Congress extends them. The president is asking for them to be made permanent. Congressman McCaul, once again, do you think that what happened today will give impetus to your cause, which is to keep things the way they are?
I think that certainly it raises the level of the debate. It makes it we're not talking about events that happened 4 years ago. We're talking about terrorist attacks and events that are happening today. And it brings home, again, it's the necessity of getting this this legislation reauthorized.
Again, Congressman Michael McCaul comes from Texas, congressman from the 10th District. Stephen Schulhofer is professor of law at NYU, author of Rethinking the Patriot Act, written for the Century Foundation's Project on Homeland Security. We're glad to have you with us, Professor Schulhofer.
Thank you.
What changes do you think need to be made, should be made, even despite what happened today in London?
Well, I think that 90% or 85% of the Patriot Act is very worthwhile and very necessary. So I do think we need to focus on just on certain ways that it could be made better. In general, there's a lack of accountability in the powers that the Patriot Act confers. The other aspect of the London attacks that I think is important, and I'm afraid that it will influence the debate in the wrong way, it does give a sense that people to want to just give the government more and more power, but I think in our debate we've lost attention to the kinds of target hardening and other protective measures that we've forgotten about. Congress just last week cut $50 million of mass transit anti-terrorism measures. So all the, you know, to talk about the Patriot Act, I'm afraid, is going to distract attention from things that can be much more effective much more quickly.
Let me go back to Congressman McCaul. What about that $50 million cut in the amount of money available for protecting transit systems? Do you think there might be an effort now to reinstate that?
Well, I do know that the Homeland Security bill was faster and smarter funding bill. We appropriated additional dollars for that. And since 9/11, we have spent over $1 billion in the transportation sector alone. And as you know, the threat has been raised with respect to transportation. With that comes additional cost of providing the canines, the additional police officers on the metro and other transportation corridors. So we are in a heightened state of alert right now.
Michael Chertoff, the Secretary of Homeland Security, famously said last week that a terrorist attack on a subway might kill 30 people, whereas another kind of attack could kill 30,000. Is that still, Congressman McCaul, the kind of analysis that's being applied, do you think, on your side of the aisle in Congress?
Well, I mean, clearly al-Qaeda has shown a ability to hit mass transit, and so that is a focus for us. But when you look at the intelligence cables, as I had in my prior job, they are looking for mass casualties. One particular threat that I stay up at night and know a lot about is a nuclear bomb that gets smuggled into this country. The borders, I think, are a serious problem right now in terms of who's getting into this country and not knowing who, in fact, is here. And, of course, under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, one tool that we used that helped in that effort were the national security wiretaps, which would help us monitor potential terrorist cells in this country. Our biggest task was to determine, are there cells here, and if so, where are they, and can we stop them before they strike us again? I will say, and if I can, the best thing, and I'm glad the professor agrees with about 85%, the best thing the Patriot Act has done is bring down this wall, which, and I was prosecuted before 9/11 and after, there was a wall between the criminal side of the House and the intelligence side, and it was dysfunctional. And the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. In fact, an FBI agent testified that when looking into a criminal investigation into the two hijackers, that investigation was blocked due to concerns over the wall. And he said, quote, someday someone will die, and wall or not, the public will not understand why we were not more effective at throwing every resource we had at this problem. Thanks to the Patriot Act, that wall has come down and has completely changed things.
Let me go back to Professor Schulhofer at New York University, author of Rethinking the Patriot Act. You said earlier that you thought that there was a lack of accountability problem with the Patriot Act, that that was one of the things that might get lost if there was so much attention paid to a kind of new urgency as a result of the London bombings. What do you mean by a lack of accountability, and how could the Patriot Act be improved in that regard?
Yes, exactly. One of the areas there, half a dozen or a dozen areas where the Patriot Act gives the government more power and then reduces every sort of check. One example is physical searches of the home, which under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the government can conduct physical searches without ever notifying the homeowner that they had snuck into the house and copied or taken anything. Another major problem is the access to documents and records, with greatly reduced accountability, so that the government has much more ability to find out what people are reading or even what their political and religious affiliations are. In all of these areas, they've dismantled the kinds of checks that we had in place before 9/11. So what's at issue here really isn't the government's ability to get intelligence. It's the ability to account for it either before the fact or in emergency cases after the fact. Nobody wants to stop the government from getting intelligence in real time, but what we need to have is a track record, we need to have a paper trail, and we need to have judicial oversight of this process. And instead, what's been happening in pursuit of the idea of giving the government every tool has also been to insulate the FBI and the Justice Department from any ability to have a public discussion about what's going on.
So, in other words, you're saying that not only is there a lack of accountability, but also a degree of secrecy involved here, which makes it difficult for there to be any debate about it.
Yes, exactly. And these are easily fixable problems. Many of these powers could easily be pursued through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which would give you a check. And every one of these powers could be the subject of regular reporting to Congress. That's something that's been systematically reduced and has been avoided. So I would suggest would be, first of all, judicial checks. Secondly, reporting so that the public knows what's going on. And thirdly, we need to have an oversight board within the executive branch that can operate to give us a kind of second look at this, even by people who would have security clearances and might operate in some degree of secrecy, but they would have independence and give us some comfort level that these powers are being used properly.
Congressman McCaul, back to you. Judicial oversight and congressional oversight, a paper trail, a track record. Why not have those in place in order to prevent abuses of new powers for the government?
Let me say this. I've worked in this arena, and I've worked counterintelligence cases, and nothing that I ever did went without judicial oversight. The great myth is that the Patriot Act abrogates the role played by the judiciary. In the intelligence arena, the information is classified, but we go through a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court that are they're federal judges. They review all this material. They review search warrants and approve. They review applications for wiretaps.
Well, is that also true under the Patriot Act? Because when you were, as I understand it, when you were in the terrorism and national security area in Texas, it was before the Patriot Act was in effect.
No, that's not correct. I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office after 9/11.
Oh, okay.
And
so you had judicial review under the Patriot Act?
Absolutely. And here's the issue. For 25 years, in drug cases and organized crime cases, we have been able to, in the Professor talked about this, we have been able to delay notification of a search warrant. And there's a reason why, because if we found Muhammad Atta's computer prior to 9/11, we would want to go in and get that information and download it before giving him notice. That would lead us to the overall conspiracy of 9/11. We have had that tool. Law enforcement has had that tool for the last 25 years. It makes no sense for us to take away that technique in what are the most important cases facing this country and national security, and that is in terrorism cases. And the same arguments made about the roving wiretaps. Those are wiretaps that follow the individual rather than an individual phone line. We have had that ability in drug cases and organized crime cases for 25 years. The fact of the matter is, in my experience, it's been easier to work drug cases and other types of cases, organized crime, than it has with terrorism cases. Mm-hmm. Because of the tremendous oversight. And all the Patriot Act did was it changed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to apply these techniques we've used in drug cases and organized crime to intelligence cases investigating terrorists.
Congressman, we need to go to a break. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Congressman Michael McCaul from Texas. We'll come back in a moment here. One more comment from Stephen Schulhofer, our attorney from NYU. Then we'll go back to London for more on today's transit attacks. On Reporter's Notebook, British officials are cracking down on potential terrorists to get them out of the country in light of the attacks of 2 weeks ago. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. I should say that we have somewhat curtailed the debate we intended to have on the Patriot Act today because of the events in London. The Congress is taking up the Patriot Act and some amendments. We'll talk about those either before the Congress acts or after it's acted and before the Senate does. We'll certainly take that up again on future programs. Meantime, I want to get back to our guest, Stephen Schulhofer, the professor from New York University. We heard a moment from Congressman Michael McCaul, formerly a U.S. attorney, deputy U.S. attorney in Texas, who said he worked after the Patriot Act was in place, and that all that was done was that the same strategies and techniques available for doing drug cases and cases involving organized crime were made available for cases involving terrorism. Is that your take?
Well, no, not at all. It's certainly part of what the Patriot Act did was to grant parallel powers in terrorism cases similar to ones that had been available in other areas, and I think that was a very constructive step, but it's by no means all of what it did. And this is where I think it may be hard for some of your listeners to follow the discussion, because there are dozens of different powers and provisions that are on the table. Just to focus, for example, in terms of these secret searches, there is a provision for delayed notification searches, and that's a conventional law enforcement tool. But what the Patriot Act does is to expand a special power under the Foreign Intelligence Act, which has searches where there's never any notice at all. Never, ever is the homeowner told that his home was searched. And that power was expanded under the Patriot Act. The other one that I would mention, because I know your time is short, the congressman talked about the fact that he always went for judicial approval. And one of the things that the Patriot Act did was confer certain powers subject to judicial approval. But what it also does is to greatly reduce the judicial approval that's required for getting sensitive documents and records, such as people's medical records or their memberships in their church or the political groups that they belong to. In these areas, the requirements for judicial approval were very greatly reduced almost to nothing. And in addition, beyond the Patriot Act, the House Intelligence Committee approved a concept called the administrative subpoena. And I believe the congressman must be aware of this because it's very controversial. The administrative subpoena takes the judiciary completely out of this process. So it allows the FBI to go directly without passing through the judiciary, go directly and obtain these very sensitive documents and records without any judicial approval.
Okay, very quickly, if we can, back to Congressman Michael McCaul. I don't want to end this segment of our program without getting your response, but we are very short of time. So the questions that I think the one most people are aware of has to do with the medical records and also library records. And if you'd comment on those, if you will, the need for that kind of power.
Well, let me say, first of all, administrative subpoenas only apply to drug cases, healthcare fraud, and child pornography cases. They don't apply to terrorist cases, and perhaps they should. I don't understand why we're rolling back the clock after the enactment of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, particularly after the tragic events of 9/11 and now the London bombing.
Okay, but what about the issue of the medical records, the library records, which have been so controversial?
Well, there is a business record. It does not say library in Section 215. Mm-hmm. It's been spun as this library exception. The fact of the matter is the Justice Department's never utilized that for library records. To be honest with you, the easier—
Why not take it out then?
Well, I think because I'll give you a very good reason why not. A guy named Mohammed Babar, an al-Qaeda operative who was caught in New York, where you're broadcasting. He's an al-Qaeda operative. He was using a computer in a New York public library. Fortunately, he was arrested, and when he was cooperating with the government, they asked him why he was using a library computer. And his response was that he knew that the hard drive was scrubbed on the computer, and he could go into a library completely anonymous and contact his operatives all over the world. That's probably why we need the Patriot Act.
Okay, quickly, Professor, very, very quickly, only on that one point, what about that? Should the authorities have the availability then to know about that in order to try to prevent terrorist acts?
I think it's a good idea for them to have access to computer usage in a library, but the problem here is borrowing records of the books that you've taken out, or even much more sensitively, the membership records of a church. It's true, as the congressman says, that the caption on this section of the law says business records, but it applies, and the Justice Department says that it wants to keep the power to get the membership records of a church, to get the contributor records of a charity, to get the membership records of the Sierra Club or Greenpeace. These are things that go right to the heart of our protected political and religious liberties.
All right. We are going to have another discussion about this, as I indicated. I hope both of you and others will be joining us at that time. Stephen Schulhofer, professor of law, NYU, and Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas. Thanks, both of you. Look forward to our next conversation.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, of course, there were four small explosions on three subways and one bus in London today, just 2 weeks after four deadly bombings hit the transit system. Nobody killed today, only one person injured. Prime Minister Tony Blair urged Londoners to get on with their lives.
What is important is that people do stay calm and react in the way that they have reacted so far. And the very purpose of the people who are doing this type of thing, that their purpose is precisely in order to make people worried and frightened, and taking responsibility off the shoulders of the people who engage in these types of act. And we've just got to remain as we've been. I think this, the one thing that's, the Prime Minister was just saying this a moment or two ago, the one thing that's come across very clearly over the past couple of weeks has been the impact, if you like, the British attitude has had on the rest of the world, where people have seen our country react to terrorist attacks that are meant to make people frightened and worried and scared and react with great dignity and great strength and great determination, that it doesn't change us. It's not going to change what we do.
Once again, that was Tony Blair standing next to the Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard. He's the Prime Minister that was referred to, the other Prime Minister referred to a moment ago. Earlier, we heard from our reporter from Newsweek magazine, Stryker Maguire, that London has been put on edge by all of this, and perhaps even more so as the day has gone on, and it has been developed that this may well have had a relationship to the attacks of just 2 weeks ago. Peter Whittle is a journalist for several British papers, including the Sunday Times and the Spectator magazine. He's currently writing a book about the English, and Peter Whittle, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
What about the history of London in this context? And can we expect Londoners to do as the Prime Minister says, get on with their jobs, or will this kind of thing really put them on edge?
Well, I think it's, at the moment, it's pretty much certain that they will get on with things, simply because they have to. In some ways, this is not like 9/11. In some ways, too, it's not even like the Madrid bombings. You obviously recall in the 1970s, there were the IRA bombings, the bombing campaign then. And in some ways, this has a similar feel to it. I mean, we're talking about, you know, different sorts of targets. There hasn't been a kind of mass strike as such. So you haven't had the kind of psychological shock that you're going to get maybe in that you did have in New York. I think that what's interesting is that this has happened right at the same time as we've been celebrating the 60th anniversary of the victory in Europe, you know. So there have been lots of parallels made with the spirit of London during that time and the spirit of the British in that time. And that came at almost exactly in the same week as the bombs two weeks ago. And I think that there was an interesting occasion then where we had a celebration for the end of VE Day. And it was a military parade, and Queen Elizabeth was there and all the rest of it. And that actually was far better attended than it would have been. There was certainly a sense on that day of a kind of defiance. There was about 250,000 people in central London for an occasion which you might say would be a very attractive target. So, in fact, I think there is a sort of sense definitely that people aren't going to be, if you like, their noses are not going to be put out of joint, you know, that they're going to go on.
Again, Peter Whittle is a journalist in England. Paul Addison's director of the Center for the Second World War Studies at the University of Edinburgh and author of a recently published book called Churchill, the Unexpected Hero. Winston Churchill, of course, the Prime Minister of England during much of World War II. Professor Addison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Is there something about the British character or British tradition that causes this kind of defiance, as Peter Whittle called it?
Well, certainly there is that tradition in Britain, but I wouldn't like to claim it exclusively for the British, because if you look at Germany in the Second World War, of course, about 600,000 Germans were killed in British air raids and American air raids, but German morale held up almost to the end. So I think that one can say that Britain isn't alone in this. And after all, look at the morale of New Yorkers after 9/11. So I don't think the British are alone in this, but certainly morale did hold up very well during the Second World War. And also during the period which Peter Riddle was talking about, of the IRA bombings, people became really quite habituated to that.
I suppose, Peter Riddle, you could point out that other places, the United States in particular, hasn't had any experience like the IRA bombing. Certainly there was September 11th, more devastating by far than any one of the IRA cases. But I guess the question here is that this seems to go on and on and on.
That's true. I think in some ways what's actually more important, Warren, is that with the 9/11 attack, that was sort of definitely something that was coming from, if you like, outside. And I think that what's been particular about this case, and I think the ramifications will be enormous, is that this seems to be coming from within, and also from the attacks have come from people who would have called themselves British, you see. And in some ways, interestingly, this really plays into a whole discussion that Britain's been having for a long time now about what actually is Britishness, if you like. So I think that the difference really is that we, if you like, it's what used to be called the enemy within. You know, we have people actually who are bombing us, but they are actually, if you like, our own people. And I think that that puts a different hue on it. It certainly puts a different hue even to the IRA campaign of the 1970s. So far, I would say people have been extraordinarily balanced in their response to it. But I do think that maybe that consensus might be cracking.
When you're talking about the insiders, of course, you're talking about the people thought to have perpetrated the attacks 2 weeks ago that were so deadly. Today, it's uncertain at this point, at least, of whether or not there is any connection. Let me now turn to Dr. Paul Cornish, who's head of international security at the Royal Institute of International Affairs at Chatham House in London. And Dr. Cornish, good to have you back on our program.
Good evening.
What do we know about the actions today that might cause Londoners to either be reassured or otherwise in light of what happened 2 weeks ago?
It still looks pretty mysterious, to be honest. I just looked on the news before I came on. The police aren't releasing an awful lot of information at the moment. I think they're, it only happened 6 or 7 hours ago, so they're still, by the looks of it, collecting whatever information they can before they make a press statement of some sort. But there do seem to have been four small explosions. So it's obviously bigger than a bomb scare, but by the looks of it, it's nowhere near the scale of the attacks of the 7th of July. Bigger than a bomb scare, but not, if you like, a real attack.
Well, in fact, it may only have been detonators that went off. And a Commissioner of Police, Ian Blair, says that apparently some of the explosives are still there. So they're going to have forensic evidence that they can look at.
Indeed. They're looking at particularly one site as a kind of forensics jamboree, I think I saw it described as, because they think they're going to get quite a lot of information out of it. But I think, you know, you asked about what Londoners and people in general in London will take from it. I think they might actually take quite a lot of reassurance yet again from the speed and the effectiveness of the reaction. And one thing we did see this time round, and I think it might have been prompted by the fact that the explosions were so small and therefore might have suggested that something was being released rather than blowing up, if you see what I mean, mm-hmm. was that there was all the incidents were treated as possible chemical contamination sites. And that happened very quickly and was very quickly dealt with, and they very quickly released information that there was no chemical contamination, so everybody went on as normal. So, once again, it all looked pretty good.
What does it say about the state of security in the London transit system that there was a state of high alert, of course, since the events of 2 weeks ago, and yet these incidents today took place? Does it appear perhaps that the people involved were thumbing their nose in a way at the authorities?
Yeah, it obviously is too early to know exactly what was going on. But this might have been a sort of copycat effort by some amateur crank gang of some sort trying to make some signal. I mean, I think what we've got to wait for is the responsibility claim, which, of course, I would imagine is going to happen, or at least in this case, since there's no suicide involved, obviously they're going to find out who did this and then find out what their motives were. But it looks to be some sort of a crank, an amateur effort of some sort. My own hunch at the moment, and it's no more than that, is that this is not related at all to an Al-Qaeda style of attack. It just doesn't look and feel like it. It looks like some sort of a copycat follow-on designed to in a way, to exploit the feeling of nervousness and fear that obviously there is in London at the moment.
Dr. Paul Cornish again at Chatham House in London. Paul Addison is still with us, our historian from the University of Edinburgh. Based on your observations of what's happened over the years, how would you compare this to other situations in London and the kind of reaction that you've seen from time to time?
Well, I think it's very different from the IRA attacks, in the sense that the IRA had a political objective, which everybody understood, though very few people agreed with, which was the reuniting of Ireland. That was absolutely clear. And the IRA also had a political wing. So in the end, it was possible to enter into negotiations with the IRA. In spite of that, public opinion in Britain continued to support the British government, the British presence in Northern Ireland, and has continued to support that ever since. That's one distinction. Another distinction, I think, which one of your speakers has already commented upon, is that in this case, whereas Londoners in the Blitz were meeting an external enemy, in this case, it is a case of the enemy within. And although there was an Irish presence in Britain, that wasn't nearly as important to British social cohesion as the Muslim presence in Britain today. And this is where, of course, it's very important indeed that this issue is handled in a way that tries to preserve unity in Britain. And it could, you know, the paranoia that can spring up when people are afraid of their next-door neighbour sitting by them on the tube in London, that paranoia has got to be checked. And so far, I think the authorities in Britain have done a wonderful job in trying to keep British public opinion reassured. And also the British public, I think, have behaved extremely well. But I'm not sure how long that strain can be sustained.
And Peter Whittle, our journalist, you indicated a moment ago you're concerned that that might be breaking down as well.
Well, yes, because it was interesting just after a couple of weeks ago when we had the bombs, there was a sense in which the story shifted very quickly, actually, almost in an unseemly way, from the actual bombs and the 52 people who had been killed, or 54 I think it is now, through to the whole problem of possible Islamophobia, that, you know, we shouldn't demonize the Muslim population or whatever. And that seemed to become the actual story. That was what one was hearing about all the time. I think that the further this goes on, the longer this goes on, if this becomes some sort of campaign, then I think it will be harder to sustain that. For right or wrong, depending on your view. And I think that the problem is the main point about this is that, as I said before, the threat in the US, or should I say with 9/11, was an external one, and therefore was a bit more cut and dry, whatever one's view on it, or on the subsequent Iraq war. Whereas here, and particularly in Europe and in Britain, there is this sense that somehow or other this is really holding up to the light all sorts of problems that have actually maybe been brewing for a very long time.
Well, we are going to discuss some of those, I think, a little bit later on our next segment. Meantime, I want to thank all of you very much for being with us. Peter Whittle, journalist for Sunday Times, The Spectator magazine, and other papers. Paul Addison, director of the Center for Second World War Studies at the University of Edinburgh. And Dr. Paul Cornish at Chatham House, head of international security there at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Thanks, all of you, very much. And, of course, our sympathies to all of people in London and in Britain generally who are having to deal so directly with these issues. We've talked about the Patriot Act a moment ago. Since the four bombings 2 weeks ago, British officials have drawn up a blacklist to stop alleged terrorists from coming into the country and deport those who are already there. Civil libertarians are concerned about overreaction. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Mormon Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. A moment ago, we heard Peter Whittle referring to certain issues in Britain that need to be dealt with. For many years, Britain has seen itself as a haven for political refugees and also a bastion of tolerance for people from different cultures. The bombings 2 weeks ago have already led to reappraisals of both immigration policies and the tradition of free speech. Ben Chu is assistant comments editor, which means he writes editorials for London's Independent. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Nice to be here.
What is the nature of what's been referred to as a blacklist being drawn up?
Well, this will be a list of all those, all those figures throughout the world, not just in England, but all those radical Islamist figures who preach a doctrine of hate against the West, the UK, the US, and everyone in it, basically. And it will be referred to and distributed, and it'll basically be a collated list, a sort of a gold list, if you like, the gold standard of the list. So people can, various governments and various agencies can cross-reference and basically find out who's a threat and who's preaching this gospel of hate, basically.
And once somebody is identified that way, what happens?
Each government will have to make up its own mind, as happens at the moment, about who they let into their country and who they don't. But it will basically be, I think the idea behind it is that it's a sort of standard, so people can say, what information do you have on this guy? Does that coincide with ours? Are we talking about the same person? Because at the moment there's a lot of disconnect. It's basically a way that various Western countries can get together and pool their resources, is my understanding.
So is this then a way of sharing intelligence rather than a way of taking action to try to prevent something from happening?
I think the blacklist is very much one about intelligence rather than action. I mean, what they're proposing to implement in this country, in the United Kingdom, is basically there's four parts to it. There's a deportation deal with various countries where we have radical preachers from these various countries, such as Syria, Jordan, who we have a deal now, or they're going to put through a deal that they will send these people back on the proviso that they are not tortured or mistreated anyway, because that was a legal handcuffs for United Kingdom government.
So send back even if they have been living in Britain for some period of time. What if they're British citizens?
That would if they were actually given UK citizenship status, that means they couldn't be deported. But mm-hmm. if they're refugee status and they abuse that, they perceive to abuse that by condoning terrorism or various acts like that.
Okay. So that's one part of it. You said there were four parts.
Yes, the second part is acts preparatory to terrorism. So this would be basically a new law which would say that if you were involved in providing logistical assistance to someone who's going to commit a terrorist act, even if you claimed that you didn't know what the end result of that would be, now any act preparatory to terrorism would be punishable by a jail sentence. So that's the second part. The third part is indirect incitement to terrorism. This is a very tricky one for civil libertarians because it basically means that if you are seen to be inciting someone to commit a terrorist act, not directly but through your choice of words, by the use of language, then that too is punishable by a jail sentence.
And the fourth?
The fourth is similar to the third, but it's acts glorifying terrorism. So this would be a classic example would be if you produced a DVD or a video either on the net or available in shops, these sort of Islamic bookshops, which are basically glorifying acts like September 11th, the 7th of July bombings in London, collating sort of glorious images of them and then indirectly inciting others to do the same by suggesting this is a good way to further the cause of Islam.
Again, we're talking with Ben Chu, who's assistant comment editor for the Independent newspaper in London. So it would be these last two, then, I think you're suggesting, the one about indirect incitement and your choice of words, your use of terminology, and four, the idea of glorifying terrorism, that would give civil libertarians the biggest problems. What are they saying about it, and is there an effort, tell our listeners how the enactment of such new laws takes place in Britain, and have they been enacted yet? Are they only being proposed, who's opposing them?
Yeah, well, we're in a very interesting situation at the moment because basically the three main political parties in the UK, that's the Labour Party, the Labour government, the Tory Party, and the Liberal Democrats, who are the third party, have all got together with their various Home Affairs spokesmen and the Home Secretary. And they've all put their heads together and said, "What can we agree on?" And these four measures are ones that they can agree on. Now, they will still have to hammer out the details about how they'll be implemented, and they've not signed away completely on it, but they're saying these are areas where I think we can make progress. And it will all come together, is the plan, in the new anti-terrorism bill, which will be presented to Parliament in the autumn.
Okay.
So there'll be those four areas where we expect to make most progress. But this, the interesting thing is that there are actually other areas which they have, I think to a certain extent, put to one side for now. And these are much more contentious. And these are what the civil libertarians in this country, including my own newspaper, The Independent, is really has an interest in seeing not implemented, if you see what I mean. And they are ID cards, which would, in time, compel everyone in the country to go around with a piece of card with their biometrical data, their fingerprints, and their information about where they live, which civil libertarians are very worried about. Then another aspect is this agenda of interning people who are perceived to be a threat without actually bringing them to trial.
Wow.
A sort of mini Guantanamo Bay in the without actually putting them on an island.
All right. We're going to try to follow that as it moves through the Parliament. Meantime, Ben Chu with the Independent newspaper in London, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Our program today produced by Christian Bordahl with Karen Radziner, Jonah King, and Francis Anderton. Technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.